coming on Christmas, cutting down trees, putting up reindeer, singing songs of joy and peace. So I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But it don't snow here, it stays pretty green. Gonna make a lot of money, gonna quit this crazy scene. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I could teach my feet to fly. I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby cry. Well, she tried hard to help me. You know, she put me at ease. Loved me so naughty, made me weak in the knees. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. But I'm so hard to handle, I'm selfish and I'm sad. Lost the best baby that I ever had. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I wish I had a river so long I teach my feet to fly. Oh, I wish I had a river I could skate away on. I made my baby say goodbye. It's coming on Christmas, they're cutting down trees, putting up angels, singing songs of joy and peace.
Michael McDermott, thank you for coming down. Joni Mitchell, yeah. Little Christmas thing.
Well, when you said Christmas song, yeah. You know, I thought there's two ways you can go.
Yeah.
So I took the road less traveled, I think.
So it's been a long time. I've seen you a little bit on and off.
Have you? I've tried. Yeah. Well, we did the ill-fated coffee.
Well, yeah. I barely remember that. But I later on I'm going to ask you about – I see you a lot at Wrigley Field. But yeah. I do want to go full circle. Back in 88, I think this is eight. When did this article?
89.
89. Yeah. So almost 30 years ago.
Yes.
Almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
I wrote about you. I must have seen you. I wrote about you for the Sun-Times. I must have seen you through Jordan, through our friend Mike Jordan. Talk about that. Talk about you beginning. You were 20 years old in 89?
Yeah.
20
yeah.
Years
so old to contextualize it, so Dave Hoekstra wrote an article that literally changed the trajectory of my life. And it's true. And Mike Jordan had moved to Hawaii.
Right.
Who was a singer-songwriter here in town that I idolized and kind of followed around like a little puppy. And tried to pick up everything I could from him. And so he moved to Hawaii. He was sick. And
right. He had Crohn's disease for a while.
He had Crohn's disease, yeah. Yes. And he was really young. He seemed much older to me at the time because I was much younger, too. And but he said, write Dave Hoekstra. And so I kind of vague – I have snapshots of writing the letter, and I really was trying to convince you to come to see the show. And I remember knowing that you were coming and knowing I had to do something to get your attention because, you know, in modern society, being boring is probably the greatest sin you could commit. So the article starts that way where I jumped on some rickety table and started playing harmonica and, you know, so – and that was it. And it worked because you wrote about it. And then, you know, one of those things. And back in the time before the internet and all that, a guy here in town –
That's back when people read newspapers.
Yeah, newspapers. Remember those kids?
Yeah.
So Jack Kelman here in town gave a copy of the article to Brian Koppelman, who at the time was a very hot A&R guy. And then the rest is, you know, as they say, you know, then he came to Chicago and signed me and all that.
See, I didn't even know it went that far.
Yeah,
I didn't
it did.
Know it went that far.
That article was on Brian Koppelman's desk. You know?
It was called Stepping Out. The column was called Stepping Out. Probably didn't name it. But Mike Jordan, talk about him. Let's tell people who I want to give him his props and who he was and what he did. I know. Tell us about the thing where you went to the Roxy. He did an open mic there.
Yeah.
He kind of told you to find your own voice, but
he
tell did. You own your own words.
So I went there. I'd read an article on him in, you know, one of the papers here in town about an open mic, and I was a kid and I was underage and I was thinking of how, you know, I was from Orland Park and what do you do? You know, I want to make records, and, you know, I thought that was my game plan. So I went there and I went to the open mic that it said Mike Jordan ran, and I waited around. You know, I don't know if I played that night, and I started talking to this guy who I thought was Mike Jordan, but it wasn't. It was Harry Waller, yes. You know, who's a character.
Yeah.
So
yeah, right.
I was getting a lot of misinformation from Harry, and so he told me that and I was like, well, Mike, you know, what do you think a kid like me should do? He's like, well, first of all, I'm not Mike, and so anyway, so then Mike came back. He was in the hospital or something,
yeah.
and then I got up and I thought, I'm going to knock this guy's socks off, and I think I did Johnny 99 or something, and after the open mic he said, hey man, stick around, I want to talk to you after the show. And I thought, this is it, man, this is how it all changes. And so I waited around, and you know, I wasn't drinking, I was 18 or something, and he said, I just want to say, I think you should really start doing your own thing, because, you know, I love Bruce too, and I love Dylan. I think I did Girl from the North Country, Johnny 99, and maybe a song of mine. And I was devastated because I thought he was going to ask me maybe to be a regular, or I had no idea what he was going to ask. And so really, he was kind of in some ways tough loving me and saying, just stop trying to sound like those guys. And then we became friends, and you know, I obviously would do anything for him, because I think the next week he asked me to help him move. And you know, clearly, I wouldn't do that for anybody really now.
But, he was a great guy. He played my wedding.
Did he? Oh,
he played my wedding.
So can I tell you one quick story about Johnny Siegel? Said I said, why didn't this guy ever? Because I knew him in the Swamp Dogs and all these great songs. And if you want, I could do even a Mike Jordan song. Yeah. But all these beautiful songs. And I said, why didn't he ever make it? And Johnny Siegel said, you know, he would come in a rehearsal and play this, you know, riff, and here's how the song goes. And Johnny said, I'd say, Mike, that's such a great song. He's like, but here's how we're going to do it with the Rock-O-Matics. And he'd go, oh no, why? Yeah. You know, he would just ruin these perfectly great songs with all this rave up stuff.
Yeah, how do we describe the Rock-O-Matics? I mean, there was a little. I mean, you can pick it up from me, but I mean, I've still got friends from the band. Angie's been on the show, the drummer. But I mean, it was a little bit of Chuck Berry, a little bit of Dave Edmonds, a little bit of Springsteen. I mean, just a great live show.
Yep.
Jordan be jumping all over the stage. Pick it up. Pick up what the Rock-O-Matics were.
Yeah, I mean, I never saw them because it was already over.
Yeah,
but I've, you know, since, and I just even last week there was a thing on them playing some festival, and it was like a poorly attended festival. There was like a gold ticketed area that was empty, and Mike was, you would think there were 20,000 people there. He was just giving it everything, you know.
Yeah.
And some of it's way over the top and a little, you know, cheesy and dated now looking back at it. But so I knew him as a more reserved, really honest songwriter. So
they did that one song. I don't know if Mike Smith was a co-writer on it.
When Little Richard gets married.
I'm going to get married too.
Michael Smith commented in the YouTube section of that thing, saying, I wrote that song.
You know what you said? It's not on my – I'm listening to you. When you – this was on my list of questions, but you went up and asked Mike Jordan questions and stuff.
Yeah.
Do people do that with you now?
Sometimes. Well, I don't know. Not that much. I had last year somebody came up, and you know, it's like, I don't know. I wouldn't know what to tell somebody.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, what do you tell them?
The landscape is totally different, you know, and so it's hard to even say. But yeah, back then there was kind of a methodology to, you know, you get a tape, you get it to, you know, fellas like you, or you know, find Craig Williams. That's what I did. You know, I kind of just did what they told me to do, and it was still kind of a model, but now that's all totally different. You know, now it's, you got to have a viral video, and you know.
Yeah, this is great stuff. We got to take a break for David Jennings and the news, and we'll be back. You come back with a couple more songs on WGN, so don't go away on Nocturnal Journal.
Take a look around, it's like whole damn town's about to blow. Sad and feel we were sitting here waiting for Godot. my tends to do when I'm alone. And all the seeds that I've planted when nothing seems to grow. Oh no. I couldn't resist, so I assist a fist if I could lend a hand. Turning like a twist, he raised his fist and said, advance on my command. Yeah, the sun was coming up and I was feeling kind of stuck inside my head. And the way that I've been feeling, I just don't understand. Man, oh man. And I have back in the storm sky, seeks the seas for answers why, wandering in such a haze, oh, these last few days. I was riding by the wasteland on a hot, high, hollow urban night. I found a treasure map into the Cumberland Gap tonight, I'll ride. Maybe I'm stuck in a rut of, maybe I should just shut up and lasso the moon. But I've never understood why I feel like something good is coming soon. Hey, I'm so tired and bad too, and everything is falling through. It feels I'm drowning in endless waves. Oh, sweet madness, you call on me so often, it's like you never leave. Hoisted by my own petard, it gets so hard to even know what to believe. I got a getaway car, I got a suicide jacket under my sleeve. And this room is oh so heavy, it's getting hard to breathe. Is it only me? I've turned a kid around my heart to keep it from falling apart. I feel so down in so many ways, oh, these last few days. And I've never beneath the starry sky seats the angels from on high. It feels like I have lost my way. Oh, these last few days. Oh, these last few days. Oh, these last few days.
That's what I'm talking about. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. Michael McDermott. Very, very good.
Ooh, thank you.
That was awesome.
I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah. Tell us about that song.
That's from the new record, Willow Springs. Well, I have a new record coming out in April, but that was the last one that really kind of, you know, my career's been kind of languishing for a lot of years in there. And this record, Willow Springs, did just, it was amazing. It was number one on the Euro-Americana chart, and the reviews were amazing. So it's kind of like, you know, I'm back on the map, kind of.
Yeah. Okay. Now you're going to... be at City Winery. I don't know how many nights. Yes. I know the 23rd, but give us two
nights. The 22nd is sold out. Okay. It's a band show. And then on the next Saturday, a week from today, I guess, yeah, tonight, there's a 5 o'clock matinee, like a solo acoustic piano show. And then there's an 8 o'clock band show.
The 22nd and the 23rd?
Well, the 22nd sold out.
Okay, so the 23rd.
Just 23rd. There's tickets for the 5 and the 8 o'clock show.
Wow, and that's been a good place for you.
It has. It's been amazing.
Yeah.
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 It's been amazing. Like, you know, and it's been like a home, you know, instead of just kind of bouncing around the club to club. But, you know, you get in with them, and then it's like getting married really early in a relationship. You know, like you're suddenly like, wow, we're exclusive. Okay. And, you know, I really like you. I have very strong feelings about you. But I didn't, you know, it was quick. It was a very short courtship. And now we're married.
Do you play the one in Nashville at all?
I have. Have I? No, I played the one in New York.
Yeah. The one in New York. Yeah. Okay. So let's do 30 years and 30 minutes. So
in 3 minutes.
Yeah, right. No, so the record, you get the thing out of this Mike Jordan Sometimes thing and all that. Then what happened?
So then, you know, in 60 seconds, yeah. So it was a lot of grand expectation, you know, a lot of success, you know, Rolling Stone, CNN, New York Times, all that stuff. And then, you know, the record didn't really connect the way people thought. So really, by the time I was 22, I was washed up. And that was a very weird thing for me to accept. Like
You're not being dramatic. You were washed up.
Kind of, yeah. You know, like it was over. Yeah. Yeah, it was over before it began.
You're looking at washed up now.
No. You're Rushmore of longevity.
Yeah, right.
I mean, really.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And yeah, that's. I mean, we both have staying power. I mean, we're both here talking 30 years later, which is amazing in and of itself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. So then it was, you know, and then I became this very entitled, spoiled, you know, cliched out, you know, drugs, drink, jail, 3 to 6 years in prison, facing, you know, and then it was the bottom, and then, you know, the slow crawl out of the abyss, and you know, it was a long one, you know, and I stayed there for a long time. And
well, now I know you've been frank in talking about this stuff, but how long? I'm not going to get too many details, but how long was that abyss?
20 years.
20 years.
Yeah,
that long.
Yeah, it was bad, and it was, you know, and you know, they say in recovery, you know, as sick as your secrets, and I had a lot of them, and I was, you know, conning everybody, and you know, it was all, you know, it's double life stuff. You know,
I know I saw one story where you said you were surprised you were still alive.
Yeah. Oh yeah. For sure. Yeah.
So what snapped? What made
you
turn around?
Well, you know, I met my wife, and we had a baby, and that didn't stop it immediately, you know. And but then it was, you know, it was just one day, you know, like she had kind of had all she could take, and so had I. And, you know, you get tired of being tired. But I had been down this road before, and I'd gone through periods of being clean and sober and never stuck. And so it's been in January 14th, it'll be 4 years for me. So it's incredible, you know.
And what was your support system like to get through that?
Just it was just going to recovery, working the steps, you know, all that, which I'd done before too, and then never, you know, I never was really committed, and so I mean, the fact that I was so frivolous with life, and I really didn't care whether I lived or died. I mean that when I say that, and it's now it's so I carry that shame around that I was so frivolous because I love life. And that's a weird place to be, and it's a weird thing to even hear myself say. But I do, I love it, and I can't believe I was such a jackass.
Do you think that? I mean, this is maybe a cliche question, but do you think that pressure at a young age affected that?
It did. Well, it did. I think that in the disappointment so early, because I really all those people that, you know, that were so believed in you so much when they stopped returning your calls, and I was just out on the plank, you know, and they were sawing it off at the boat, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, and my wife and I talk about these kids today. I mean, I know that sounds makes me sound terribly old, but yeah, I don't know how they do it. I mean, it's just a terrible amount of pressure for anybody young, you know.
So what's it like when you look back on those days? I don't want to ask you personally, but artistically, how do you look at your body of work when you were going through? You
know? Well, I think the work became more self-indulgent than it needed to be, for sure, because it was woe is me. You know, look how terrible my life is. I mean, I found a lot of good songs down there, you know, because, you know, there's a lot of, you know, when you but it was a pity party, I think a lot of it was. And so I tried to, you know, I deconstructed my life to the point where I hung out with some very colorful characters, and that was great fodder. It really was. And but then, you know, then you realize you've been down there so long, and you know, you're hammering comforters over windows to block out light for years at a time, you know.
I know I can't think off the top of my head, but I know there's cliches in rock and roll about artists who have sobered up, and then they weren't as good as they were before.
Right.
But then I think Warren Zevon, he sobered up, and he was still good.
Yeah, no, that's a definite thing.
Yeah.
You know,
about that.
It was a concern. So, yeah, so then I make this record, Willow Springs, and I think, oh, geez, it's a bunch of, like, is anybody, you know, and I started losing kind of perspective. So when the record came out, and it was just like, it was such a confirmation to me as an artist that I can write sober, and it was great, you know. And so now I just like it. I'm up sometimes at 4:30 in the morning, and I'm writing. Just I get up and write. You know, it's like I'm making up for a lot of waste time, because I wasted so much time. You know?
Yeah. Where's the title of the record come from?
Willow Springs. It was the town I live in. You know, so it's kind of, it was, you know, I was here in the city, and then we moved out, and you know, we're, you know, 20 miles south and 20 miles back in time, 20 years back in time, and so it was just a place of solace, really, and just like, you know, and my dad died, and I was a father, and it was just so much was going on, I could barely take it, and it was really just where that was my real bottom, I guess, is just coming out of that that real 20 Year Darkness, really.
Wow. We got to take a break. Yep. We're going to come back and talk a little bit about the documentaries.
Okay.
Doing a documentary. We're taping tonight.
Yep. So okay.
Don't go away on Nocturnal Journal. Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720 with Michael McDermott. I can't believe I've known you this long.
I know, right?
30, it'll be 30 years in 89.
I remember we met at Guthrie's Tavern or whatever. I remember that. I mean, it was like it was my biggest moment. And really, I had no idea what would actually come from it. But it really changed everything.
Oh, thanks. That's, I know you've lived around a lot of different places. Did you live in Memphis for a while?
I did. Well, I was down in Memphis probably 6 months. I love Memphis. You know, it's below sea level, so it's nice. You know,
and Jim Dickinson always used to tell me that's why all that great music came from Memphis.
True.
The humidity and the river.
Yep.
And yeah,
that's true.
He really said that.
It's
different.
Everything's different.
He really believed that.
Yeah.
Jim Dickinson did.
Yeah.
But where I'm going with that is what kept bringing you back to Chicago? I mean, I know it's home, but is there more to it?
It was family. You know, my family got ill and came back as somewhat of a caretaker. And then, So, after the election last year, we talked about getting out. And I don't know. You know, I don't know why I stay. And it was never my dream to stay. You know, I mean, I lived in Los Angeles, lived in New York, and, you know, so many great places in Italy we thought about. But, you know, I travel so much that kind of almost doesn't matter where I actually live, you know.
I'm not kissing up to you, but you know, I'm a Cubs season ticket holder, and you do a great. I always see you at the ball games on Sunday.
Yeah,
I think it's always Sunday. Is it always Sunday? You and your wife.
Because I'm a diva, and I said, you know, if you're going to get me out here, I want to do two songs.
So you do the national anthem.
They actually took me at my word, which I couldn't believe. I was cracking a joke, but it's great.
But it's great, and I they show the dugout, they show the players, and they're listening. And you're not. I'll say it. You know, you're not about yourself like John Vincent. I mean, you just do a really really great great thing. How did that happen? How'd you get in the ring?
A friend of mine did. I think a friend of mine, Joel Azar, and then I became like anthem guy. Like after 9/11, you know, I was doing it for the Packers and the Lakers, and I was. There's no money in it, you know, which was perfect for my life. And but it's fun. And it's obviously taken on a whole new thing, you know, this year and all that. So, it's intense, you know, and it's because it's 1 minute, you know, it goes, it's already over when you're walking off going, how did I do?
But you really do it with respect and dignity.
Thank you.
You don't jazz it up.
I thought, like, how would Woody Guthrie do it? You know, like.
Good. Is it a hard song to sing? Everybody says it is.
It is. But, you know, if you start low enough. It's not too bad.
So we've got they're taping you in the studio tonight, and you're going to be the subject of a documentary with Fred Yuter. Fred?
Yes.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
So how's it going? You getting everything you need here?
It's really good here, because this is sort of full circle now. That's why it's very important for the film.
Yeah, that's good. So tell us about the documentary and why you picked Michael and how you guys came together.
Out of a hat.
No, actually, I ran into you at a... was some small bar, and I walked up to you and said, hey, I want to make a documentary on you. You said,
buy me a drink and you could do anything.
You said you got two other guys making them. Tell me more about it.
Yeah, I did.
Really? You did?
I did, yeah. And, you know, people kind of get, they look under the hood and they get scared, and then I never hear from them again. But, you know, it's a very, it's a time, you know, it takes so much time to do this, and you would be able to expound on that. But you know, you avail yourself, but then these guys then would just disappear, and it's like, boy, years. I had a guy for years following me around, and then like, what is he? Is it just got a closet full of just footage? You know?
Yeah. We're working on one too. We've been working 3.5 years on Springfield.
Yeah.
But what attracted you to his story, and tell us what you can about the documentary and when it's going to be out?
You know, Michael was one of the guys who, you know, I'd always think about the greatest songwriters ever, and there was always Springsteen, Dylan, Cohen, Matt Ryan, and it was all these guys who I always thought were incredible. And he was one of the guys, and it's hard to believe you could run into him at a bar, you know. And then you saw his trajectory, you know, the little you know about the trajectory, and you go like, this is an incredible story. And I mean, and he came out the other end, and it's just like, and Michael thinks he burned a lot of bridges, and that's where the stories I was trying to get. But nobody has said anything bad about him. Out of, you know, I've had probably 30 interviews with people.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
And they're...
had 30, really? That many?
Oh, yeah. We got like Joe Shanahan and Peter Himmelman and Matthew Ryan and Don Dixon and Joe Hardy.
Yeah.
So all these big guys, and they just say what incredible he was, and, you know, even when he's messed up. Even when he's messed up, he could do it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Were you hard to work with when you were messed up?
I was fairly delightful. I think, all of it.
Well, tell us about Don Dixon. That's at REM. People might know. What was it like to work with him?
It was great. He was
When was that? I've got it down.
That was 93. Yeah. And he was just so incredible, like the most musical guy, you know, of all the, you know, Don Gaiman I worked with right before that, who had huge success, but he wasn't very hands-on. He would just kind of lay on the couch and tell you to
That's what I've heard. I like talking. I'm not a producer. I've never made a record, but I used to talk to Ken Nelson, the old Capitol Records guy who did Haggard and Buck Owens, and he was the same thing. He would just, like, stay out of their way.
Yeah.
It's like a good editor.
Yeah,
you know?
He's barely there. He just kind of comes in, listens, and goes off for lunch.
So did you have people like that, or did you have people who meddled?
I've had both. Yeah, and I guess, you know, the thing now you make records like on satellite. You know, you could just send stuff to people.
Yeah.
So which is nice, because I think there is a freedom people have. It's that, you know, the Brady Bunch thing, when the red light goes on, there's something changes to everybody. It's just we're just programmable machines. So, you know, things different. You know, people do things for different reasons. So I think, but then Dixon was so musical. He was just, I mean, like one of the greatest singers ever. Like, you know, if you just hear heard that guy and just go for it. It was amazing.
He did Marshall Crenshaw, didn't he? So I imagine that he might have, I'm just comparing stuff, he might have maybe pulled some Marshall Crenshaw stuff for you.
He mentioned him. Actually, the last time I saw Dixon was with Marshall Crenshaw. I mean, they were at this thing in Florida, but Dixon's great. I mean, I've been really lucky with the people I've worked with.
So, Fred, so tell us when the documentary is going to be out.
We're looking, should be done with editing and sound by middle next year. And then I'm hoping to, you know, start the film, the circuit, and see where we can take it and see, you know, the whole distribution thing, which takes forever. But it's just coming along so well. Let me just say that, you know, it's going to be unconventional. It's not going to be, I mean, there's, in Michael's life, there's duplicity on where he was and, you know, and he's making amends. And so it's not going to be anything you've ever seen before. It's
live performances and stuff.
Live performances.
I never asked you. I have interviewed you a few times, but did I ask you what it was like growing up in Arlen Park? I mean, what did your folks do?
They sold insurance.
Did they?
You know, Woody Allen said, you know, there's one thing worse than death is being locked in a room with an insurance salesman. But I got to say, my father was not that. But yeah, it was very dull. You know, Orland's now just kind of a burgeoning suburb. But then it was just dull. You know, I just wanted to get out.
You did.
Yeah.
You did. So, okay. Plug away. Tell us about the City Winery shows.
City
what
Winery,
else you got coming up?
December 23rd, a week from today, two shows, 5 o'clock, 8 o'clock. And then new record. I met Prine. You know, there's a cruise they have, Kayamo.
Yeah, right.
You heard about this?
Yeah.
I met Prine, and I saw him in the Star Bar because they kind of keep everyone isolated. But I went up to him. I said, "Mr. Prine, I'm Michael McDowell." He's like, And I said, "You know, you were a bit of a religion for me, because the guy I followed around, Mike Jordan, was, you know," and he went, "Mike Jordan, he died, didn't he?" So he remembered Mike.
Yeah. John's a great guy. Yeah. I wanted to ask you also, do you do anything with the Westies?
The Westies are still, yeah, put out two records. Going to do that. Those songs take a little longer because they're more kind of crime based. So we'll do more.
Tell who the Westies are.
I don't want to be all inside here.
So
it's a band. You know, I always just wanted to be in a band. That was the whole idea. The reason I became a singer-songwriter is because all the singers would just never show up to rehearsal. So I just became like by absentia. So it was great. It's great to be in a band and, you know, have other people carry some of the load too, which is nice. And my wife's in it, and she, you know, so we do most of the singing. But yeah.
Well, we're gonna go off with a song here, but thank you. You bring out the energy in me. That's rare, Mike. I'm usually not this energetic. So thanks, Michael McDermott. Thanks, Fred, for bringing the crew in. Thanks, Tom, for producing tonight. Set up the song.
All right, this is a song that Mike wrote. He told me about it the last time I saw him before he died in a car accident. It's a song called Whiskey and Water. And I put it on my second record, and I wanted to have the publishing go all to his family, and they said, "Don't," because he was so in debt that they would have gone to creditors. So they said, you know, I mean, not that it made much, but yeah, it was terrible that even his estate was, you know. So, but anyway, this is a Mike song. It's just a little place around the corner. It's called the Watering Hole. My credit's good with the bartender. There ain't a soul in the joint I don't know. It's got a real sweet sound and jukebox, and it plays my favorite song. It's called One More Whiskey and Water.
one more whiskey and water. One more whiskey and water. I play it all night long. Hey, what are you doing on my bar stool? Yeah, that's my change and those are my cigarettes. Ah, take it easy, man. Don't get excited. Stay cool. Besides, you ain't even heard my favorite song just yet. It's called One More Whiskey and Water. One more whiskey and water. One more whiskey and water. I play it all night long. Now talk is cheap, advice is free, and I told you the joke, you're telling me. All right, all right, all right, all right, I'm going. What the hell did I do with my keys? And by the way, while you're locking up and closing, would you mind if we played that tune one more time, please? It's called One More Whiskey and Water. One more whiskey and water. One more whiskey and water. I play it all night.